the world or other people in relationship with us change also. But we can only directly change ourselves. You have direct control only over your own behavior. Unfortunately, this idea is in direct opposition to the unspoken contract that is often established and signed between two people in a relationship, especially in a marriage, which is, I'll be responsible for your happiness and you be responsible for mine. The net result of that is usually two unhappy people. Think of the disappointment when we find in a relationship that the other person really can't make us happy, and that the other person doesn't even often want to be responsible for making us happy. From that kind of contract, of course, it's easy to conclude, if I'm unhappy, if the assumption behind our relationship was I'll make you happy and you'll make me happy, if I'm unhappy, what do we find? It's your fault. If I'm not happy, it's because you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing in the relationship. And of course, what's the answer to that? The answer to that is, well, let's find another relationship. Maybe there's somebody else out there who can make me happy. Right? And of course, we know the dead end, or some of us, I know the dead end from working with people who, in marriages, for example, and I've had this, I suppose in a way, unfortunate opportunity to work with people in one marriage and to have them come back in a second marriage with basically the same problem. And oftentimes, although it's a tragedy in terms of what's happening to marriage in our country and in our society, many times, at least people who do come back in a second marriage say, I know now I have to work on this. I have to find out a way out of this because I can't just go looking for somebody else. But that first time, we don't often believe it. I don't know who said it, but I've heard it said, it's always kind of made me smile, that everyone should have an opportunity to go to town to see the elephants at least once. Essentially the idea that that we really don't believe it until we see it or we live it ourselves. And so we tend to want to give up on a relationship, a friendship, and try it with somebody else. And yet we find that if we're into this business of you make me happy and I make you happy, that it's simply not going to work. So we have to give up trying to change the other person and to go to work on ourselves. When we do that, when we work on our own behavior, our own feelings, our own experiences, we dramatically reduce blame. And I always count it an important therapeutic step in working with people in conflict in relationships, especially in marriage, to get them past the blaming part, to get the couple who comes in about their marriage, to get them past this person does this to me and then she does this to me. They always just want to talk about, in the beginning, the other person and what that other person is doing to create problems for them. When they can start talking about themselves, when we can start talking about what we do, when we can start acknowledging, yes, I think one of the things my wife has struggled with is the fact that I always speak in lists, then we have a chance to begin to work on that problem. But if I take it from the perspective of my wife always blames me, you're always criticizing me because I have a list of things, then it's not in the right perspective. Okay, so the first and maybe the most important is you can only change yourself. The second is that you have to accept the other person in the relationship for who they are. Not who you want them to be or what you want them to be. You have to work at seeing this other person's point of view. You have to try to understand where they come from. Those of you who have been in a couple of the earlier sessions know that we've been working at, from the point of view of forgiveness, working at first trying to look and see who this person really is that has hurt us. Trying to see them not from what we think they are or what we would like them to be, but from what maybe they really are below the surface. So you have to examine your expectations in your relationships to see if they are reasonable and appropriate. This whole business of expectations might be as important as anything else in learning to get along with other people. Reminded of someone who mentioned Carl Rogers' notion about how relationships and sunsets should really be viewed, or other people and sunsets should be really, really be viewed in the same way. And that is this: when we look at a sunset, we don't look at that sunset and say, gee, it needs a little more purple over on this side, or if the orange were just a little brighter hue over here, it would be such a much better sunset. Rather, what we do is that we just kind of marvel in the unfolding of that sunset, how it moves from one level of color to another, how the clouds come in a certain way, how the water looks, how the sun looks at different levels as it drops below the horizon. But what do we do with people? We do just the opposite. We say, just a little more salt. If you could just be a little more this way, if you could just stop doing that, if you weren't this, if you had this part of you that weren't so big and this other part of you that were bigger. We don't look at people the way we look at sunsets. So we have to work at, in a relationship, accepting the other person for who they are. We have to value who this person is, because we can't build a relationship on the basis of what is wrong. We have to build a relationship on the basis of what is right in the other person. And that means looking at expectations. Instead of expectation, we talk about acceptance. Third, we have to learn to recognize and express our feelings. Those of you who were here last week, if there were any, and we talked about men and some of the struggles that they experience in their lives, we talked about the fact that, especially in this feelings area, many of us as men have found it very difficult to express feelings. Some of us even have difficulty identifying feelings. And I talked about the fact that I've encountered men who tell me, or who have told me, I don't feel anything. And they really don't. They don't feel anything. And we talk about the fact that the worst feeling is not to have any feeling at all. So that even though feelings are a part of a relationship, and feelings are an important part of a relationship, we have to learn how to recognize and express those feelings. And we have a couple of guidelines for that. One, words are as important as actions. This is especially true for men. Men tend to act often rather than to talk. And so if you're learning to express feelings, especially from a male point of view, it's very important to learn how to put feelings into words, not just actions. This is often true in a sexual relationship. Words not sexual. Words not feelings. Words not actions. I'm getting ahead of myself here. I use that word sex and I got all... So many times, from a male point of view, the expression of feeling is the action, the sex act. From a female point of view, so often the emphasis is on the language, the communication, not just the act itself, but the saying of the words. And so it's very important to learn how to use words as well as actions. Both are important in expressing feelings. I talk a lot with people about walking and talking as a way of learning to communicate more effectively. Walking and talking is good because, one, you're participating in the exercise mania in our society. If you're walking, and of course you're doing healthy things for yourself. Two is, if you're walking in your neighborhood, you can't get too vocal about expressing your feelings or too loud, because the neighbors will hear you. And so it kind of keeps communication at an effective level. The third thing in recognizing and expressing feelings is for us not to be historians in the expression of our feelings. You know, what a historian is, a person who says, you always do this to me. Or you never tell me how you feel. Or this is the fourth time that you've told me this or that you've done this to me. We need to focus in the here and now. So recognizing and expressing feelings and learning some communication skills is a very important part of healing relationships. Four, we need to learn to apologize for our part in a conflict. Again, for those of you who've been with us, we've been talking about the 30% rule in relationships. The idea that in every conflict between people, the likelihood is that each person has to own at least 30% of the conflict. There is that argument about who has the 30 and who has the 70, but we all participate in relationship conflicts at some level. There is an involvement on our part, either passive or active, that contributes to that conflict. And so the 30% rule needs to be kept in mind. We also talk about the notion or the need to reframe this business of apologizing. So many people see apologizing as giving in or giving up. And I like to talk about apologizing as giving to rather than giving in or giving up. So that when we apologize in our relationship, when we identify what part we have had in the conflict, we are saying, I want to give to you the consideration that says, I am involved in this too. So if we can reframe this business of apologizing, it can help us in our relationships. It isn't a question of surrendering, it's a question of serving. It's a question of giving to rather than giving up and acknowledging our part. Number five, we need to learn to forgive. And we need to learn to genuinely forgive. Forgive comes from the Greek word to tear up the bill. And so what happens when we tear up a bill? We give up the debt that is owed to us. We learn to give away the debt that that person owes to us. We have to eventually forgive and forget the injustices that we feel or think have been done to us. We've been talking, of course, in some detail about this process of forgiveness. And we've been talking about the fact that forgiveness is a decision, not a feeling. We can't wait around in a relationship to a point where we're ready to forgive based on our feelings, because our feelings are exactly what are the problem in our ability to forgive. We don't forgive because we feel so upset, and we are not going to feel better. We're not going to deal with the feeling until we make a decision to forgive what caused the feeling, to reframe again what happened. We have to decide to forgive if we're going to be able to forgive and to forget. We also talk about forgiveness not just being a decision, but forgiveness being a process. That forgiving is a conscious decision. It is a conscious decision that often has to be made over a period of time in a number of different ways. That we don't just say, I forgive you, and all of a sudden everything's gone. If you remember yesterday, we did an exercise where we wrote out, I forgive you, and then we wrote what our thought was. And there were a lot of other thoughts that came after I forgive you, like, no, I don't. I'm not ready yet. I don't want to. I don't care. I'll never forgive you. Because forgiveness has to be worked through. And out of that forgiveness, of course, then can come the healing and even forgetting, as we discussed. So that healing can come out of the pain of being hurt. Actually, without the pain, there is nothing to be healed. And we've been talking, I think, throughout the week, and at least throughout the time I've been here at Holden, in the Bible studies and in the presentations, about the fact that in the midst of that pain, whether it be in personal relationship, whether it be in struggle with God, whether it be in international struggle, that the hope is in the struggle, that God is in the midst of the pain. And that's true in terms of our personal and our relational pain as well. That without the pain, that in some ways, as I think James says, we should count it all as joy, that in the midst of the trouble and the pain is the opportunity for a relationship with God and the potential for healing. So we have to accept some of the things that happen to us and struggle with those things and learn to deal with those in a new way by forgiving them. Okay, number six. Understand what you do to others, both good and bad. The golden rule applies, but the tarnished rule is a part of our experience too. When I value, love, and accept you, I do the same to myself. When I act toward you in a way that I want to be treated, I get that back. On the other hand, when I criticize or attack you, I attack myself or I invite attack from you. Well, it's a little bit, it's easy to understand, I think, that when we criticize someone, we're more likely to get criticism back. But what does it mean when we say, when I criticize and attack you, I really attack myself? This can be understood through something in psychology that we call projection. The idea that a great part of our response to other people is really an expression of feelings or attitudes toward ourselves. That when we are criticizing someone else, when we are angry at someone else, when we are hateful towards someone else, the core of those feelings are often feelings that are directly associated with, but unconsciously associated with, feelings we have about ourselves. When you think about the most critical and angry and hostile and rejecting person you know, when you think about their behavior, when you think about the hurt that they inflict on others, where do you think that person is coming from in terms of their own personal stance? What kind of person does that? What kind of person is dumping out anger and criticism and complaint? It's the person who feels often very unloved, who feels very inadequate, who feels very much hurtful and angry toward themselves, who feels that they aren't worth much. And what do we do with that? We take that and we project it out on others. We do that because it's too painful to think about the fact that we are unacceptable. And so we find ways to identify unacceptableness in other people. We find ways to express our anger that really is directed at ourselves. So we have to understand that in relationships, what we do to others, we are typically expressing in many ways toward ourselves. But the good news is that the other side is true too. When we can forgive others, when we can love others, when we can care about others, then we can also care about ourselves. Again, there's so many connections at Holden Village. In our Bible study this morning, Paul Hansen was talking about how is it possible, you know, and the criticism always is, how can you love somebody else if you don't love yourself first? And in some ways, if you don't love others first, if you don't express that love for others first, you can't love yourself. That in fact, loving ourselves comes through caring and loving others. And then lastly, one last thought on this category. one of the ways in which we have to understand that what we do to others, we do to ourselves, is that we are all related. We are not separate. We are all brothers and sisters. We are not just separate people. We have to see that not only in our relationships, but of course in our communities and in our world, that we are not separate. We are together. The old question, am I my brother's keeper? The answer is no, I am my brother's brother. Am I my sister's keeper? No, I am my sister's sister. 7, and I guess we can only have 7 rather than 10 because we're running out of board space. Develop your sense of humor. You have to have a sense of humor, and you have to learn how to laugh with others and sometimes at yourself if you're going to have any sense of healing a broken relationship. So much of our time here this week has been humor, and I, as a psychologist, it's interesting to me that the week that has had the most tragedy, I think, for this village, and the week that has been maybe the most difficult one in a lot of ways is the week that has had the most humor in it. I think it's because we need that kind of experience in our lives. I think we gravitate to it. I think we establish it. When out of that hurt, we have to find some other way to deal with those feelings. I think it's very therapeutic. I think it's very important. There is help in humor. Some of you may be familiar with Norman Cousins and his book, The Healing Heart, and his experiences with, actually, that was a later book. He had an earlier book that the title escapes me for the moment. But Anatomy of an Illness, yes, where he talks about the fact that one of the ways in which he helped contribute to his own cure and his own recovery from a significant illness was by simply spending time with humor and laughter every day, watching Three Stooges movies and Abbott and Costello and reading humor and laughing. One of the joys of my Sunday morning is to sit down with Sunday newspaper and to read a guy in the Chicago Tribune, but he's probably syndicated throughout other countries or other cities and newspapers, called Dave Barry. Dave Barry writes in the Sunday magazine, and I just get usually a belly laugh out of that. It's just a good feeling to be able to laugh out loud at his particular brand of humor, which strikes me in just the right way. So you have to have a sense of humor if you're going to make relationships work. Let's get 3 more in here. Number 8, when you can't laugh, cry. Brokenness causes pain, and pain hurts. But as we've said, it's the experience of pain, and it's the living with pain, and it's the working through pain that leads to healing. In the midst of our pain, we are poised for the kind of renewal that's available through Jesus Christ and through our God. Sometimes we have to be broken open enough to get some other input. We have to be broken open and available to a new way of doing things. We spend a lot of time looking for our own solutions to very serious problems in our life. We spend a lot of time struggling to find the answer. Sometimes the answer doesn't come till you give up, until in the midst of a tremendous amount of pain, you're available to some other learning, some other understanding that often in that situation were available to opportunities from other sources than ourselves. So that when we're struggling and we don't have the answer ourselves, we have to look to others, we have to look to God, and many times it's at those points that we can come to a new understanding of what it is that we have to work with, what it is that we have to do. 9, check your will. Not the last will and testament, but your living will, so to speak. Your motivation for healing, your motivation for your change. The passage that I've noted here from John 5, verses 1 through 9, the sick man who Christ heals on the Sabbath, what is the question that he asks? He asks first, do you want to be healed? So often the will is not there. And I always talk about the fact that the will is far better than the skill. That in changing relationships and healing relationships and solving problems, that if you have the will, you can learn the skill. But the skill will not work without the will. There are times when I work with people in counseling over an extended period of time, struggled with them through problems, trying to get some kind of solution, working with them around techniques to bring healing into their relationships or into their own personal lives, and we don't make it. And oftentimes I think it's because of that part, because the will was not there. Oftentimes work with couples over an extended period of time, and then after about 3 or 4 months, one of the couples will say, well, I really didn't want to be in this relationship anyway. That's a crisis of will. You know, we come saying, yes, let me figure out how to work out this relationship. And yet, at another level, somebody is only half involved in that situation in terms of their will. The commitment is not there, and the commitment to work, the intention to work, and the relationship is not there. The same is true, of course, of earlier when we were talking about forgiveness. You have to have the will to forgive. If you're not ready to forgive, if you don't want to forgive somebody, you can't forgive them. But you can't wait. You have to make a decision for forgiveness. We talk about Christ asking the man if he wanted to be healed. We have an opposite example of Christ's encounter with somebody else in his encounter with the rich man. He says, teacher, what good deed must I do to have eternal life? And of course then Jesus tells him what he's supposed to do, and he's done them all. He has done them. The skill was there, but the will was missing because he can't do the final thing. He can't make the commitment of will. He has the skill. He has kept the commandments. He has done what he needs to do. But it is without the will to really be in relationship with God and to really share. He knew what to do, but he didn't do. So again, a crisis in will. I'm always reminded of William Glasser's quote about people and will in terms of relationships. William Glasser wrote a book, he's written a number of books, but he wrote a good book called Reality Therapy that focuses on a way of dealing with problems from a reality standpoint. And Glasser is one of those guys, one of these psychiatrists who cuts through all the jargon and kind of says it the way it is, and sometimes it just comes out as basic common sense, which is okay because that's very good many times. But his quote about the fact that he doesn't understand why couples who plan to stay together would argue on a chronic basis. I mean, what's really the point? If you really intend to be in relationship with somebody, what's the point of fighting with them all the time? Now, it's true, of course. An occasional argument and occasional confrontation is necessary to clear the air, to get things straight, to assert feelings. But if we really want to be in relationship with someone, then these things become far easier. A decision to apologize, a decision to forgive, a decision and an intent to communicate. These are things that involve will, not just skill. And the will is always more important than the skill. The last one, in terms of healing relationships, keep your hearts and minds in Christ Jesus. How do we do that? Actually, I usually say keep your hearts and minds in conflicts. The good news is we don't have to do it all by ourselves. The good news is that there is a God who cares about us, who cares about our relationships. So oftentimes, however, I think we leave Christ out of our relationships and out of our struggles. I know that this is true for me, that the focus so often is on what do I have to do to solve this problem? How can I figure this out? Out of my own sense of what I am supposed to know and what I am supposed to do, what is it that I need to do? Now, it doesn't mean, of course, that we just we have a problem, sit down and say a prayer and pretend everything is okay. I'm always reminded of the old Norwegian proverb that says, in a storm, if you're in a boat in a storm, pray, but don't stop rowing. So I think we have to really have both our own efforts, but we have to keep those efforts and conflicts in our relationship with Christ. How does that translate into specific relationships and problems, for example, with couples and problems with other people? I don't think we pray enough probably together at times, especially in families and in marriages and in relationships when we need to. Again, I think our own family, we get caught in ritual prayer. We get caught in prayer at table. We get caught in prayer at church, and those are good prayers. But there are other times to pray as well. There are times to pray in the midst of conflicts. We can ask for the strength and the support and the healing we need. There are times to pray together as husband and wife about our relationship and about our struggle. There are times to pray as family in the midst of conflicts that engulf us. When we avoid or ignore that avenue of help, we cut ourselves off from the help and healing that is available through our God. There's a book with the title, Your God is Too Small. So oftentimes I think that's true for me, that I think about God in a way that is a very limiting kind of way. And I think about God as being able to help in only certain ways and only at certain times. And yet we have messages and we have scripture and we have promise that tells us that when we ask in prayer and when we ask in faith and when we ask in Jesus' name, that there is help available to us. All right, those are my 10 ingredients for healing and helping struggling relationships, broken relationships, good relationships. I'd be interested in getting you to talk a little bit both about your reactions to these or any questions you have about these, as well as getting you to talk to me about the things that you have found in your own relationships that that have helped and healed. And Pat and I then could kind of discuss with you some of those issues. So any reactions to any of that or any additions to the list? Yes?
I'd revise your list.
Okay.
I would put the will at the beginning, the motivation and the will, the very first thing.
Okay, the will at the top, that certainly does have a crucial part in it, doesn't it? I guess I hadn't thought about a particular order with one being more important than others. As a matter of fact, though, when I did this list at our men's group, our pastor suggested I put this first. And so I think there would be different orders that we might come up with, but good. I think certainly will is extremely important.
In response to that, I think we're often not ready to find out whether our will is involved. We want to explore all the other things. And then when it comes to making some kind of conscientious decision of action, that's when we need to know whether the will is there or not. So, I mean, it's an either or.
No. Often we come up against that issue in so many ways. We want the easy answer. We want the book, the word, the communication, the pastor, the psychologist, the scriptural verse, anything that will solve the problem for us. And yet when we look and when we see that those things don't magically change, then we come up against, okay, where do I stand here? What do I need to do to, what is my intent? What is my will?
My reason is the first step is so hard, you have to have that first.
Okay. But if I put that first step there, and then maybe they wouldn't listen to the other nine because they say, well, that's too difficult, I don't want to do that. Yes, I think you're right.
Well, I think touch is really important.
Touch?
Touch. And that makes, I mean, that really takes a big step to be able to touch someone that you're in conflict with.
Yes.
A friend. And I think that helps them to know that you're with them and you're working things out.
I agree. And perhaps that would be a good subset under that terms of expressing feelings, that not just talking about feelings and although I kind of subheaded that maybe under acting on feelings, but actually the separate category of learning to or increasing our touch with other people, very valuable. I told a story in the first week on our discussions with men and expression of feelings, how I have a memory of my father touching me that stays with me to this day, of a time when I was about 15 years old and we were in church on Sunday morning at sunrise service on Easter Sunday morning, and I was feeling, I hadn't had any breakfast, feeling kind of faint, and I kind of just was a little woozy. My father put his hands on my shoulders and just kind of, you know, rubbed my back a little bit, kind of held me to him, kind of held me up. And he wasn't a real touching person, but to this day, I have that memory of that time. One of the few times I think that, I'm sure he touched me more than that, but that stays in my mind, a very positive memory of my father. And I think so often we don't take that opportunity to touch those close to us.
We can add touch and teach.
Touch and teach, yeah.
And when you were saying that, when you were doing that too, Joe, you left one out, is we talk about walk and talk, but meet and eat. When you see, sometimes it's important that people go out to dinner and have conversation and talk. And when I counsel, many times you can't believe how many people do not have, they don't take the time to do that, to really talk at their meals and get away from the kids, no kids. And I will have them schedule in a time that they can go out for either a breakfast or a dinner or a lunch together once a week and have this time alone to talk with each other. I often have lowered people's fees because they've said they can't afford it, and I say, I will charge you this much less. I would like you to do that. Can you do that? It'd be amazing, the healingness that has come.
I do want you to stop short of inviting them over for dinner.
I like what you said about forgiveness, about the tearing out the bill and throwing it away. Do you recall a Greek word?
No. As a matter of fact, that I'm not a biblical scholar. That comment that came out of when I gave this talk once before, a guy came up to me and said, do you realize that it comes out of the Greek word to tear up the bill?
So it's really quite a picture of thinking of forgiveness as tearing up the bill and throwing it away.
You don't owe me.
Right.
Yeah. And so many times, it's good to elaborate on it. So many times, the issue in forgiveness is you owe me. You hurt me, and now you owe me, and I am going to hold you to this. I'm going to hold you in my mind and in my gut in a way that says, you're not okay, and I'm upset with you. I'm going to punish you.
Yeah. That's what keeps the boxing gloves on, too. You have to move couples away from that point of where they lay down the boxing gloves and deal with the today, 1987. What are they going to do about it?
Pat and I tend to slip into talking about relationships in terms of couples because we do so much couples work. But again, I would want to see these things not just for marriages, but for relationships in general.
I was thinking, I found this very helpful. I was wondering if this model, these steps more for like fairly healthy relationships to begin with, because there's certain things that I found in my life coming out of my background that have, like when you come from a family system that's disturbed or you're in relationships and you have to learn, like if you're grown up that way with mm-hmm. people who are definitely evil mm-hmm. and you can't see everything as 30%. Or you can't see everything as projection, mm-hmm. because often in family system, you know, certain things happen that are done to people, and you have to learn how to say no. And the saying no to it at the first stages is a really important thing, which I don't think that you talk too much about. That, like, if you're in a system where the parents are abusing the child,
yes.
the child right. grows up, they can't say, "Well, I'm 30% responsible right. for that." Mm-hmm. You have to say, these people have treated me really wrongly, I have to forgive them, but I don't take any responsibility. So they're an alcoholic people, they're, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's a lot of more complicated
yeah,
stuff.
We have been talking yeah. about, I think if there's one place where this would not apply, it would be in a child looking at his relationship or her relationship with their parent. And we've talked in the other sessions about the fact that a lot of these kinds of things don't apply to an abuse situation, a parent-child abuse situation, because it's awfully difficult to hold a child accountable for physical or sexual abuse at the hand of their parents, or emotional abuse even. But that grown child in relationship with others does have to begin to see their part in a relationship with somebody else.
But don't you think that often when you grow up in that pattern, it might take a couple of years, you might get into bad relationships because you're just repeating.
Sure. Well,
then you have to kind of wake up and say, no, 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 this is not right. It might take you like a number of relationships before you can. So this
sure.
is basically for fairly healthy people.
No, I would stop short of that. It isn't just for fairly healthy people, but I agree with you that it can't really be readily applied in a situation where there is a parent-child situation. Now, where that abused child grows up and comes into relationship, in a friendship, or with their own children, or with in a marriage, they are more handicapped in that relationship. But these would still apply, in my opinion. So they would struggle more in a relationship. Some of us are better off than others in terms of what we've been taught and what we've experienced. We have to see, too, that everybody is handicapped in some way. Some of us have been abused. Some of us are the parent or the children of alcoholics. Some of us are the children of righteous parents. There's all kinds of struggles and problems, and I think at the adult-to-adult level, we have to own those. Some of us are more tuned into them. Some of us have been hurt even more deeply than others. But I think these would still apply.
Often victims in the situations you're describing have to get over the fact that they don't own part of that, that they are not guilty for that, and they don't even need to forgive themselves for that because they didn't contribute to that. And that is a real hard step for them to get over. And once they are over that, then they can get into this learning to forgive and struggling to take the relationship beyond them. But that's the only handicap that would prevent these 10 things from taking place, is to get over that feeling that you have to be guilty.
It's defenses, you know, mm-hmm. if you're raised in certain kinds of systems, you have defenses. It's hard to, I don't know.
It's self-esteem.
And
you have to love yourself.
And then you drop them as you get older, but it's...
Well, does it help you for me again to say that, that some people would come with more skills to apply these, or some people would come with more... with a better, with more potential out of their background to use these things, but that everyone needs to use them.
Well, I think these are really, really good. I'm just saying that I think that there needs to be another part in a conversion, like it's a really good unit, but some people have to build a conversion unit to be able to plug into them. And just speaking as a person who finally has built conversion unit, I used to always go to talks like this, and I'd read these, I'd try them, and they never work. And until I'm able to do it, because there's another whole psychology, I think, for a group of the population who have had certain kinds of patterning as they grow up.
And what is the conversion? What was it for you?
Well,
I mean, just generally.
Did I have a right to identify evil in other people when they're hurting me and be able to point it out? That it's okay to do. You know, if someone's really being nasty, I don't have to accept them the way they are. Mm-hmm. I can say, I don't like that because I think that's really wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important to be able to say, I don't have to accept people. I mean, I have to accept them, you know, but if certain people are doing nasty things, you don't have to just accept them. Because if you're grown up in a system where you're taught to be passive and accepting of all the evil around you and be a good kid, do you have to be able to say no? I don't accept that. And if you don't, I won't be in relationship with you at an intimate level if you continue to do that.
Okay, good. That's helping me to understand more. But then what I hear you saying is that the transition for you was that you had to decide whether you would stay in a relationship with a certain kind of person, whether you would accept a relationship with a certain kind of person. Right?
Yeah, that's part of it. Or just even to get it focused.
All right.
That was the transition. But I think that's one of the key things for me is to be able to not feel guilty about saying no.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What you're saying, I think, is that before you get to these 10 things and use them in a relationship, you have to go back one step and decide, is this a good relationship for you? Do I even want to be in relationship with this person?
Yeah.
But, okay, I buy that. I think that's true. And I think we all have to do that in some ways. But then I think once we get into relationship, if we're in relationship, and if we've chosen to be in relationship, and the intent is to be in relationship, then these apply. Is that
That makes sense. If you can work through to that, and you really like someone, you trust them, then you're into that. But I think a lot of people can't get to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. Isn't that involved in the first step?
What was the first step again? We erased it. Learn to
yourself.
You can only change yourself. How do you see that involved in the first step?
Well, I see that is a rejection of responsibility for behavior of the other people, but just as she said, I don't have to be a part of it, and that doesn't have to apply to me. I have a choice.
Does that connect for you?
Yeah, but what I'm trying to say is that when you're in this certain place, it's not like you can make those choices right away. It takes a long time to get up to it. I mean, you can, but pain, like inside of people, is explosive and non-rational, you know, and a lot of it's unconscious, and you have to take responsibility for as much as you can. But I think it's good to try to get people to, can you sustain relationships, or is it just all pain? If it is all pain, you might have to ventilate for 6 months with somebody who's going to listen to you or something. I mean, but most people in the society aren't in screaming pain all the time, it seems to me. I don't know, it's hard to say.
You know what I hear you saying, too, is, you know, we can get in a pattern of relating to in a doormat fashion, and that you had to change that fashion of relating, that pattern, before you can move on to getting into relations that were less destructive.
Yeah.
Because you see this and perceive this as probably for healthy relationships, but for some reason you were in the pattern of getting into relationships that were highly destructive because you learned to relate in a certain fashion.
Right.
Is that what you were talking
about?
Yeah. And that I can see that step would have to be dealt with and worked with.
Good. Harold?
Yeah. One thing that I just thought of too that might help here would be if when I would deal with people of that with those intensity of problems, I would say stuff the 12 steps of AA between 1 and 2 here, between deciding to change only yourself and accepting or understanding the other.
Mm-hmm.
Just put the 12 steps in there. And first of all, come to realize that you're powerless over your own life and will. Decide that there's a power outside of yourself that can change you, and then decide to turn over your life and will there. Making amends where you will not further harm yourself or another person. All of those you can put into that.
Mm-hmm.
And that would deal with the evil, the resistance, the unchangeableness in another person. And it would deal with those relationships which are too hard to even stay in. Because when you turn them over, to turn the person over to a higher power or God, then you are saying that I can't handle it, you take care of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may, when I reflect on some of the people I deal with, I think that would be where I would put it, just between 1 and 2 here.
Okay.
And then add 12 more steps in.
That's 22 steps though, Harold. No.
Well, if you got a difficult relationship, you need 22 steps.
That's half a journey there.
You also come to the concept of the victim, isn't it? I mean, the one who supports that person as the enabler.
Yeah.
You know, I like the concept from the 12 steps of relinquishing, because it really pries that problem, you know, out of your hand. But I do think you have to get to a point where you assume responsibility for your own life, and you have to get to a point where you say, I want something different. You just can't just say, here, God, take it. You know, I think you do have to first pry it open, because I can't handle this. And with the help of God, come to some decision of how am I going to change this and work at it.
Yeah, that's why you would add the rest of these right. 10 steps,
mm-hmm.
because then you're learning how to handle the situation in your own life.
Right.
How closely are steps 9 and 10 tied? What do you do with checking your will? Can you affect your will? Or should you start off struggling to find out whether you've got the will, or should you, as you said, should you do steps 1 through 9 or 8, and if they don't work, ask yourself whether you have the will.
Well, I'm not sure. I don't think I see the steps as sequential in any way. Or at least as it put them together, I didn't see them as sequential. So I don't know that one would do all the others before number 9, or that one would do
sometimes
number 9
you might,
first or last.
Sometimes you might say, someone might think they lack the will,
mm-hmm.
and be mistaken somehow. Or, I mean, it seems like struggling with your will, sort of like pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Mm-hmm.
You have it or you don't, or can you in fact mm-hmm. strengthen your will? Or
mm-hmm.
it seems like sort of a.
It is a.
It doesn't lead anywhere, it seems like. And
well,
the 10 can affect it.
Well, I think. I think it is, it does have a bootstraps quality to it, I agree. Will is intent. It's our conscious decision that says, I can or will to do this. What I mean by checking your will is that it's important to see, if you're working on a problem, especially on a relationship problem, it's important to see what do you want. There. What do you really will for that relationship? In other words, if you're in a situation that you're not even sure you want to be in, and maybe you're even thinking about getting out of, you have to understand that. You have to understand that that is a part of it. Some people know that all along. Some people don't know that. Some people know that only at a kind of lower level, or I don't want to say unconscious, but at a subconscious level, if you will, and have to come to understand that. And so I don't know that they can make themselves do something that they can't do, but it's important to know if you can do it. And so it's important to know in the area of forgiveness, as you look at this situation, and you have to examine not just how come, or I don't feel like forgiving, but you have to also examine, if you don't feel like forgiving, do I want to forgive? That's what I mean by checking your will. What is the internal part of you saying about what you want? And if you find, I don't want to forgive, then can you make yourself forgive? That's maybe the question that you're getting to. And I don't know the answer to that. I think that probably is dependent on each of us. I think then, though, at least we have the start for the possibility that we could make ourselves forgive. If we understand the problem I'm having is I don't want to forgive, then we can ask, why don't I want to forgive? Then we can look at what's blocking me. And in that way, perhaps, begin to work on what our will is and get to a point where maybe will could be more intentional, could be, yes, I now know I can begin to forgive. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense to you?
When you say that too, Joe, you're asking them to check the payoff for not forgiving. What are the payoffs? And there's some payoffs for some people for not forgiving. They need to keep this going, this negative.
It reminds me of if some of you were in the conference or the session on acceptance. Remember, we talked about the book Forgive and Forget. There's a little fable in there, Fuchs' fable, and Fuchs' wife committed adultery, and to the surprise of the townspeople, Fuchs didn't turn her out. He kept her with him. But, as the fable points out, he kept her with him. Why? Because he intended to forgive him? Because his will was to forgive her? No. Because he hated her and he wanted to punish her. And he punished her with his anger. And so that's what we mean when we talk about will. What is the point here in this relationship? That's what I think Glasser was talking about when he said, what's the intention in the argument? Is it to communicate or is it to punish? Is it to hurt? Is it to say to you, you're not, I don't want you, I don't like you, I don't care about you? The will kind of is threaded throughout our motivation in our relationship. And the first step is to check the will. What is our motivation? What do we want? I think I said before too, awareness is the first step to change. So we always have to be asking ourselves, what is it that I intend here? Because if I don't know what I intend, if I think I'm doing one thing and actually I'm intending another, then I don't know something that I need to know that's valuable.
I think it's helpful if you really do reach a dead end. I mean, you can't really fool yourself and sweep it under the carpet if you're really not forgiving somebody. I think it's helpful to turn it over to the Lord and really believe that He's going to take care of the judgment. Like in somewhere in Psalms, I think it says, He'll heap hot coals on your enemies, you know. And if you hold it within yourself, it's poisonous. I mean, yeah. It just doesn't do you any good. And if you truly reach a dead end, I think it's helpful to just turn it over at that point.
Yes. And leave the judgment to God if there will be a judgment. Let God decide that.
Mm-hmm. For me, it helps, too, that we don't have to forgive 100%. That if I have something against someone else, I can forgive whatever I can on a scale of 0 to 100. And if that's only 1%, then I do my part. And I say, I forgive you 1%. Mm-hmm. And I ask God to help me with the remaining 99% that I can't forgive. Mm-hmm. So that I don't have to feel like I have to do the whole 100%.
Even if you're participating 1%, at least you're participating.
Or 0.0001.
0.001.
That's like your magic eyes and taking one stone away at a time.
Yeah. It's a process, isn't it? But it never starts. The process can't be put into motion. The wheels, the gears can't start turning until we say, yes, I want to forgive. I will to forgive. Mm-hmm. And then, as you're pointing out, it can be maybe a, perhaps even a lifetime process.
Maybe this is a little bit different, but I think it's really important, you know, in the midst of all this type of stuff, to go and have fun together at the same time as the process is going on. And sometimes it's easy to forget to do that.
In a relationship, you mean, as you're struggling to work on these things, it's important to have some fun, too. Sure.
Lots of fun.
Yeah.
It's a little bit.
Right.
But it's easy to forget that.
Yes. Yeah, everything gets real serious. We've got to work on the problem. We've got to worry about this. We've got to do that.
Yeah.
This gentleman has
It seems to me that, well, talk about my own relationship, the conflicts I've had with my wife and things. And one of the things that learning to solve, first time is the hardest to say that I was sorry. But if you start looking at the good things that you see in your mate or that person, and you keep looking at them and excelling on that good point, it's pretty quick the things that you see that was conflicting with you, you almost overlook them, you don't see them anymore.
Yes. Yes. That we can choose a perspective, can't we? That we can choose to see things positively or negatively. To a degree, we can choose that. It doesn't make it go away. It doesn't automatically change everything. But seeing the glass half filled rather than half empty can make a big difference.
Well, we need to focus in on the behaviors. You're right, when you talk about behaviors, and we, as a society and as people, we have a tendency to focus on negatives more so than the positives of an individual. So I think it's really important what you're saying, keep it in perspective. When you're having a problem with the person, don't let that cancel the whole person out because they have a behavior that you are struggling with.
Right, that's what I'm trying to say.
One of the things about will is that it's not just a matter of being in or out of the relationship. It is your expectation of the relationship you may want to be in. It seems to me that the issue among couples is frequently that they have different expectations of a relationship they both want to be in. And that becomes an issue. I mean, what kind of intensity, what
yes.
degree of depth, what issues do we really care about?
Yeah.
And so there's different wills, both within the relationship. Yeah.
That's that second point, I think, that expectations point, too. And it's so dynamic, isn't it? Because not only, it changes. I mean, sometimes on a day-to-day basis, it changes what kind of relationship we want to have, or on a year-to-year basis. And sometimes, there's this constant dynamic tension as we, I don't want to...